So I, you know, I've worked with undercover agents for 25 years. I'm even gonna, I can't even comment on this, but I see all kinds of things around this filing and around things that I haven't filed yet that scream out undercover agent activity. But
It's
again,
replete. It's redundant how much of that
it's
screen
all over the
everywhere.
place. So what, and by the way, I actually don't even, again, other side of the table from me, they're as much a victim of this as I am, right? Because the way that the discovery disclosures were structured, and by the way, this could have been set up in the days and in just a few weeks following January 6th, where they thought they were looking at something different, you know, maybe even like an organized effort to overthrow the government or something, right? Like they thought that's what they had. So things in investigative files, oh, who's going to need that? You know, that doesn't matter. And so they put that on a track that would even not even be prepared before some, you know, like this discovery hasn't been turned over to many defendants. Like the information in the investigative files, which is exculpatory, hasn't even been handed over to defendants yet, some of whom have pled out, right? So they're gonna have legal claims. So the system's creating a mess.
That's a great question. So these people that have pled out, I don't know that maybe some people that have, been pled out on a minor charge and they got 2 months probation or maybe 2 years probation, 2 months house detention, $5,000 fine, or even a $500 fine. They may not even bother going through the process because of the expense of legal fees and that sort of thing to go out and have their records expunged if there's additional exculpatory information released by the federal government. But certainly some of these guys who are now being, because we're starting to see prison sentences now in the, the 60 to 78 month, length, so far, particularly one of the Oath Keepers who just pled out last week. Right. So,
Ulrich, who
yeah.
saw through his change of plea. I mean, that should be a warning sign to people, but you know, people are going to take different interpretations of that. But I think I know what's behind that. Go ahead.
So if these guys who are willing to take a 5, 6, 7 year prison sentence as a plea deal to not be convicted of seditious conspiracy, you're saying that they will actually have the legal right to come back? I mean, like for instance, this guy, this is a more minor example, but the guy who was in fact acquitted and the judge said that he had a reasonable understanding that he was allowed to be, in that building that day. And so the judge acquitted him 100%, you're free to go. Well, why aren't people running back to their attorneys and going, Hey, get this crap off my record too.
The initial media coverage of this was 24/7 oversaturation coverage, around 3 to 5% of what happened, the most outrageous
Correct.
actions, much of it, I suspect, engaged in by some of whom were crisis actors and probably provocateurs. And let's just say they're independents with zero connection to the government. And that, I can't even imagine that the government have anything involved with that. I have a hard time believing that. I'm a former Fed myself. And that just was hard baked into people. And to the extent it was hard baked in the entire country, where the entire country started to retaliate again. I mean, this is the most disturbing thing. You want to talk, go back and look at the Great Leap Forward in China, where children were informing on their parents. I mean, like, how anybody would want to get involved with the refit factual situation where the government just went right into the middle of this family and worked as a informant and cooperating agent, where there was use of recordings that the defendant and the family, other family members were not aware of. You know, these were things the federal government kind of just said, ah, you know what, I want to go focus on other things. It didn't specifically authorize it or endorse it or approve it, but it just through what it chose to act, the case selection process, the investigation, it just chose to focus on other things.
Let's jump to Harrelson because as you are well aware, I'm personally over 2 months into developing a story about Ken and his family, Ken's background, not only just as a human, as a average middle-class working American who has a background in the U.S. Army, who was a welder for SpaceX, who was looking for a way to serve his community and went online, looked up this organization that he didn't know anything about called Oath Keepers. He has this background in the military. It looked like this was a situation where his skill set could be used and taken advantage of as a servant to his community specifically. And he joined up. Fast forward then to January 3rd. By January 3rd, he wasn't even going to DC. He was talked into going to DC because they needed his help, because there was a secondary stage that was going to be at the Capitol that day where a list of speakers were going to require additional security that was not going to be provided by the government itself. Like it was going to be provided down, at the rally where Trump was. Obviously, wherever Trump is, he's going to have Secret Service and everything he needs to protect him. But there was going to be a secondary stage up at the Capitol about 2 p.m. was when those speakers were supposed to launch that day. Of course, that got disrupted and derailed by everything that happened. But he went specifically with the knowledge and the intent of providing supplemental security to the speakers on that secondary stage. Everything happened, all hell broke loose, and fast forward, and we can get into as much of this as you want to, but the bottom line was, and let's just say it as clear as we can say it, if there's any single human being completely innocent of violence, breach, interference with the function of government that day, and hell no, seditious conspiracy, does not exist in the DNA of this human being or his intent for even being in the Capitol city or the Capitol building that day. In fact, many of his personal actions indicate the exact opposite, as he put his body in between maybe the most famous officer of that day, Officer Dunn, and a group of potentially violent, agitating protesters. And he put himself between the two of them and stopped that interaction from getting out of hand. This guy has not only been held since what, March of 2020? When was he arrested?
March 14th, I think.
March 14th of 2020. You just sent me a picture a week or so ago. I mean, he has not been allowed for over a year now to cut his hair, shave his beard.
He got a haircut 3 weeks ago. Let him get a haircut, yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, good. So, okay, but the point being is for over a year, he was not allowed to cut. So he's having to go on these Zoom hearings with the judge. And of course, you guys love prettying people up and cutting their hair and putting makeup on them. And you make people look good before they go to the judge. Well, he's not allowed to. So he looks like a wild man from, coming out of the, a cave somewhere or a Neanderthal coming out, when normally he's a high and tight guy. And because I've seen all this family, family videos, and he was high and tight on January 6th, but because of the limitations of what they were given access to in the detention center and that sort of thing, he was having to make his appearances before the judge looking like a wild man. And I can't help but believe that was purposeful. Surely that wasn't just an oversight. I don't know. I mean, it's beyond me that these guys were treated the way that they're treated anyway here in the United States, because this is how people are treated in Guantanamo, and they're being treated that way in our nation's capital to a large extent. So with that said, I have been working on this story. I've interviewed his wife extensively. Obviously, you've given me and granted me access to him in the detention center, and I've interviewed him there. I thought it was rather ironic and fortuitous that he called in during this podcast as we're recording this. Certainly, I will leave whatever amount of content you'll allow me leave of that phone call in this recording here. But let's go to the Harrelson case specifically, and let's talk about that. Let's do the elevator pitch of how you got on board on his team, because he had previous representation.
Yeah, he had a couple, one, two, three sets of prior counsel.
Wow. And I didn't realize it was three sets.
I'm a big advocate for Bill of Rights, so I'm out there on every issue, Bill of Rights. They found out about me. I came highly recommended. I started talking to Angel.
His wife.
His wife. Mm-hmm. You always hear the story. Everybody thinks their loved one's innocent, right? And I'm like, okay, you know,
sure, of course.
Look at it. I opened my eyes, started looking at it. I'm like, I just started seeing.
Jeffrey Dahmer's mom thought he was, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's clean.
And I started looking at it. And the first thing that struck me was that it was pretty much known by the defense counsel that the door might have been open from the inside.
The east.
And it's in the east. This is a Columbus door is on the east. And I just thought it was, I took a quick, you know, I went around and I made some calls and I'm like, gosh, it's strange to me that people haven't dug into that because that's like really an important key fact. Because of course I looked at the indictment, they're being charged with breach. Breach has technical meanings. It's basically, you know, punch through one meaning is punching through a wall, right? So
for people that are not, and I'm going to provide the links to the Epoch Times because it is covered a little bit in that story, but for people who don't know, or, you know, too long didn't read meme or more meme oriented people, describe, first of all, there's an outer door at the Columbus doors. There's this big gigantic bronze door, that some 20,000 pound door. And the first videos that I saw of that door, it was closed. Who opened that door?
So by the way, we couldn't figure out what much of this is still a mystery to us. The Congress, when we went on a tour, literally I was threatened that if I asked a police officer a question about the key on the door, I would be forcibly ejected. Mm. You know, this is like, and of course, oh, you don't want me to ask those questions?
This was when the defense counsels were being given a tour of the Capitol.
They make, again, this is like the immense consideration and gratitude and graciousness of people on the other side of the table from us. Mm-hmm. They have organized these tours of the Capitol. They happen, you know, every few weeks. And there's a group of 20 to 40 to 50 to 60 defense counsel that traipse through the Capitol. And of course, I'm very interested in the Columbus doors for obvious reasons, because from the day I arrived on scene, I thought that how everybody was behaving in relation to these Columbus doors, my spidey tingles were just like activated in such a strong way. I was drawn to it.
Sure.
Both in terms of how defense counsel across the platform are responding to it and how the Capitol was responding to it, how the discovery returns seemed to be trying to get around it, how the initial video that we got was edited. I mean, everything was just wrong. This awareness too, again, you're always looking back. I didn't know all this stuff in October, November, you know, all this sort of just, when you come on an investigation like this, where your client's been charged and you're in the fifth superseding indictment has just been issued, mm-hmm. right? You're drinking from a fire hose on any case. On this case, you were being hit by a dozen fire hoses and you're just trying to basically survive and stay afloat, right? That's kind of the gig. Later on, I guess it was maybe in January or February, I had a tour of the Capitol and I wasn't able to take video of the doors. I wasn't able to spend much time outside in front of the doors. Everybody was all hinked up. They wanted me out of there as fast as possible.
Those minor types of treatments to the defense counsel at all raises those suspicions. What are you hiding from me?
What is there?
Why can't I take a video of this?
Of course. The whole thing is what happened in front of the Columbus door.
Right.
And of course, this is after I discovered that, gee, there's hundreds of, at this time, we didn't even have access to the video, but there's 24,000 videos. That includes body cam information from NPD, but also all the surveillance video in and around inside the Capitol, around the Capitol, and 24,480, I believe, that we haven't had access to since 7 or 8 weeks ago. So this tour is before I even have real meaningful access to that information.
Right.
And I can't get a straight answer on, is there surveillance video in front of the Columbus door? Because earlier in the first or second week of January, the government expeditiously handed over this French video crews, documentary crews, high definition video that basically shows on high definition video other actors that are actually doing the things that the Oath Keepers are accused of.
Right.
And no one's ever seen him before. I'd never seen him before.
Okay. Yeah. And let me stop you here. You probably remember this, but I called you one day. This was the first time I ever read through the Harrelson indictment. And this was before the charges were upgraded to seditious conspiracy. This was just his original indictment. And I'm reading the FBI affiant's complaint against Harrelson. And I read with my own eyes what I knew instantly, not instinctively. I knew from evidence that was already available in the public sphere that there were flat out lies told by the affiant in this indictment. There's no way that this particular FBI affiant saw the same videos that I have seen and accused Harrelson of the things that he was accused of. He never had a single hand on one of those doors, yet he was accused in his original indictment of he himself breaching the Columbus door.
All right. Okay. What I would say on that is that it wasn't a false. My understanding of it now is that's not a false statement. That's just a misunderstanding of visual information where people are overwhelmed by visual information. If you come in and you're looking at this through these blinders, which everybody was, and by the way, including me when I came under the case, this is a common affliction of what happens in the wake of a spectacle event where there's 24/7 media saturation around 3-5% of it. Like the 9/11, the plane going into the building over and over and over again, you know, like that has a psychological effect on everybody, no matter how much of an objective constitution premised individual citizen you are, you're affected by that.
So you're saying that an FBI agent who ostensibly is charged with investigating this particular individual, and then he's presenting in his indictment all the evidence, you know,
too many visual inputs. It's too much. It's too much for one person time frame.
His phone calls, his telegram, or rather his signal communications, his text communications, the people that he was associated with, where he was, whatever, that you're saying this FBI agent just got so many details wrong.
I'm saying that when you're trying to deal with a spectacle event where I now believe there were people, let's say that they have no agency or connection to the U.S. government or to a state government within the United States, that when you have a cluster of these people engaging in activities that mesmerize, bamboozle, fool, disorient. These are trained professionals, and these are technologies that have been developed over many decades.
Thousands of years.
Right. And used to be held within the United States government and maybe a few other governments. And there even wasn't much transfer between, say, like Western governments and, say, like Asian governments like in China. But because of the internet age and all this stuff, and because a lot of our information has been compromised over the last two decades, all that stuff got out. And then you had sharing and you know, like things that the Chinese government was doing to infiltrate the nationalist Chiang Kai-shek operations in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, I suppose. All that stuff was come across and gathered and translated, and all that stuff was like integrated with stuff that we'd learned in Western operations. And the bottom line is here we are now, and we have all that trade craft, all this intelligence stuff that's associated with intelligence agencies that's gotten out. You know, in the old days, I remember being surprised that Richard Nixon had a cell phone in the limousine. I'm like, wow, 1972, he had a cell, like, whoa, what technology? Now we all have it.
Right.
You know, back in the day, the military guys, some of the early units, I think in 1990, Desert Storm, there was some GPS stuff that was in the military side, right? But it hadn't crested over. Now it's on all of our devices, right? Same thing happened with tradecraft. And it got out of the government, and there became markets for it out in the private sector, competitive intelligence. You know, competitive intelligence used to be all done by governments. Now law firms do it, cloak and dagger firms do it.
But back to specifically with Harrelson, I'm not you know, an attorney.
That agent is tasked with an obligation that, or like, it's like, try to observe this visual information. And by the way, the visual information was limited.
Yeah.
Because there's surprise, the U.S. Capitol has surveillance videos all over the place. The place is blanketed. Except the front entrance.
Right.
I mean, like, think about, you want to talk about oversights.
No, wait a minute. Does the front entrance video just not exist, or there's no cameras there, or it's just not been released yet?
Very hard to get an answer on that.
Because it seems that seems like, I can't even imagine that's the case, that they don't have every single square foot of that surveilled at 24 hours a day.
One thing I know is if the agents and the prosecutors on the other side of the table for me had access to that information, mm-hmm. I would have had it a long time ago, right? So they don't have it either. And, you know, getting back to where the failure is occurring, it's not at that level. It's at Congress. It's over and sideways from them. This information is getting bottled up. I mean, I find it hard to believe that there wasn't surveillance video from the front entrance, because that's where, in the United States, everybody pretty much has their surveillance video at the front door. You would think that's where Congress would have it, but it doesn't. And inside the door, they have three angles. By the way, I just learned this 7 or 8 weeks ago too, because prior to this, I had two segments of video that were provided to us. And it wasn't until maybe 8 weeks ago when I realized there was a big gap cut out from the center. And I'm like, well, I want to look at that gap. What happened during that gap? And lo and behold, there is some interesting things that happened during that gap. But that doesn't mean that the people outside of the table of me had anything to do with that or had any knowledge of it, right? I believe that most of what is in here came to them as a surprise.
Well, me not being an attorney, and I mean, my hair went up on the back of my head, and I called you and I said, look, you know, Brad, why isn't somebody pounding, you know, I know you can't do this, somebody pounding the judge's door down and say, he didn't do this. This thing that is in here that says he did these three things, he never did them. He couldn't have. He wasn't even present at the moment that these things took place. And we have video proof that he was nowhere near the scene of the crime. And why then, after we know that true, and now, and weeks and months have passed, even since I, in my, you know, lack of understanding of the legalities of this situation, I know that they did not happen. And yet this guy is still being held without, you know, opportunity for bail.
Lots of reasons why that is. I don't blame the court. One of the reasons why I haven't gone back in and actually asked for a hearing is because I don't think the court is in a position right now to release the three Oath Keepers who are in confinement for a variety of different reasons.
Political. You
know, well, I recognize that. You know, I'm focused on the impossible position that I feel myself in, but I also have the presence of mind to recognize that we're all in impossible positions, and the court is no exception, and it's doing the best possible job that it can.
Let me ask you, because I think that this is absolutely germane to the conversation, is that, talking about the politics, in March of 2021, when Ken Harrelson was arrested and the original complaint was filed, and these accusations as far as I'm concerned, have been irrefutably proved to be false accusations against him, were originally crafted by the FBI investigator. And this was put into the public domain, because obviously it's out there. I can download any of those filings. And so this information is there, and he has not been charged with conspiracy or sedition at this point whatsoever, not, you know, seditious conspiracy. So this charge does not exist. You fast forward now to January of 2022, and now we have the week-long commemoration events that Nancy Pelosi, Speaker Pelosi, has put together commemorating the tragedies and the insurrection of the previous year. And one of her This was the key phrase, which she released in a press release and then said it on stage. I was there. Remember, I was there covering the commemorative events all week long. I was at all these events. And Nancy Pelosi said over and over and over again that the purpose of those events, the purpose of the committee were this is an exact quote, is to establish and preserve the narrative. Now, while she's saying that on the week long anniversary commemorative events, the other side of the press, and even some of the press that would be more ideologically and politically aligned with her own thoughts on this particular set, were all asking a very specific question. They said, you keep calling this thing an insurrection, but how come nobody has been charged with sedition or insurrection? Over and over and over again. Finally, and obviously we had been asking that question for almost a year for a year at this point. Really, it's an insurrection. How come nobody's being charged with insurrection? It's a sedition. How come nobody's being charged with sedition? I guess, you know, those are the worst federal crimes except for, you know, treason or whatever. And so finally, her own press from the left side of the aisle are going, yeah, why is that? Why is nobody being charged with those, you know, more extreme criminal charges? And then suddenly, one week later, what was it, on January 13th or 12th, something like that? Boom. All the Oath Keepers, nobody else, were charged with seditious conspiracy. And they had already been charged. These guys had all, except for Rhodes, had not been arrested yet. I think he was arrested that week. But the point being is that this charge didn't exist until their own press turned on them and said, what about that? How come you keep using those words, sedition and insurrection, and nobody's being charged with that? And then it seems like they selectively picked a group. I mean, they didn't charge the Proud Boys with that. And we know beyond any shadow of a doubt, when the Proud Boys go to a riotous event, they go there to knock heads. That's what they do. That they like doing that. the Oath Keepers don't do that. This is not what they do. But that's the group that was plucked out and charged with seditious conspiracy. And was it a coincidence that it happened exactly 1 week after everybody was going, hey, Nancy, what about this insurrection thing? Sorry to tee you up like that, but
wow,
that's one of my big questions.
Yeah, what I can say about that is the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she's acting and behaving in a way that I would expect a House Speaker to act. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he's behaving and acting in a way that I would expect him to act and behave. You know, that's their elected representatives, and it is what it is.
Where did the pressure come from to upgrade their charges, though, from the typical 4, 5, 6, 7 basic charges that they had, you know, breaking and entering and violence and trespassing and all that? Why did suddenly in one fell swoop were they all upgraded to suspicious conspiracy and nobody else was, people that actually did real violence?
Yeah. I don't know if I can comment on that, but what I'll say is, philosophically, this case aside, sedition laws are something that should only be gone to. First of all, I don't think they really have a place. So my personal view is that we'd all be better off as a society if we got away from that statute. The long and short of it is, it puts front and center state of mind, which is very hard to prove or disprove. And it eliminates the requirement of an overt act.
And things we say in a passionate moment are then used against us for a charge of sedition.
See a lot of that. Like everybody has the uncle or the father or the mother or the brother who during the Super Bowl starts, you know, yelling that I'm going to kill you, you know, so-and-so, whoever the quarterback is that blew it. We all have weak moments as human beings. And there's an aspect of this that this happened to freeze frame people in their worst moments. And it put communications that otherwise would never and should never be subject to government scrutiny. It elevated their importance and skewed all meaning. If somebody says, I'm going to kill you, Robert, and the person's a mother, And it's because Robert just got home from the supermarket and left off the bananas from the shopping list.
Right, right.
Or the banana souffle or whatever.
Yeah.
That's different than, I'm going to kill you, Robert, when you're Jeffrey Dahmer and, you know, it's your next victim, right? And all of that has been, every single hyperbolic comment that was made over a block of time by anybody, regardless of meaning, has been given, this meaning has been imputed to it. And it can the problem is it can happen to all of us, right?
Because
it
can happen to any of us at any
they've
time.
They've been recording all of our conversations every day to Ping since 2007. And the system, these systems, not individuals implementing the systems, we're all, like I said before, we're all rats in a cage, but the systems are training themselves to get better and better at this capability. And whether you're a hospital patient that can't get early treatment, who ends up in a hospital, can't blast themselves out and are being administered remdesivir, which has a 40%, 30 or 40% chance of shutting down your organs,
right,
and ensuring that you get onto, you know, be intubated and probably 90% chance of dying, whether you're that person or you're somebody who shows up as a rally attendee within the Beltway on that day, that has all your geofencing turned over and all of your Facebook communications turned over. And while they're conducting an investigation, they have you in a big pool and they're doing, you know, they're sending, dispatching people out all over the country, doing investigations, scaring everybody, right? While that's all happening, that information is being weaponized and put into a social credit system that's being developed under the radar, that we're not going to really know the full scope of it for another couple decades.
Well, even you and I, in our own private conversations between just ourselves, you have often, when we've engaged in a conversation, done a disclaimer, or you've basically quoted off a notice to whoever's listening to our conversations in advance. So this is the, you know, attorney-client privilege. You're not supposed to be here. Just letting you know that anything that we say right now, you can't use it anyway, blah, 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 blah. You go through this whole statement when we're talking on the phone. And part of the reason that you do that is, A, we know that we're being recorded. We don't necessarily know that we're being listened to, but it's just being archived and it can come back to haunt us at some point, anything that we say. Hopefully anything that you and I say together, because we have an engagement, you know, a legal engagement together. Hopefully nothing that we say in our private conversations can be, but you and I, we get, you know, because we do this spitballing thing, you know, we've done some of it here on this, in this recording here, but when we're on the phone, man, we're throwing ideas out there and some of them are inflammatory. Some, you know, and we've joked about, well, I don't even know if you're joking when you talk about it. We joked about, you know, hey, if I'm not off by tomorrow, I'll be there, you know, for the hearing, by tomorrow morning or whatever. So, you know, like yesterday you got the Epoch Times article about you and your quotes and all that. So yeah. You know, if I'm not off this morning, I'll be at the hearing this afternoon and that sort of thing. But so we say things like that, and some of them are joking, some of them are half joking. And you know, as it relates to January 6th, because so many of these more minor crime defendants who have just been charged with, you know, trespassing and interfering with the function of government, they've had SWAT units and tactical units from three or four different agencies show up at their doors in the middle of the night. And, you know, so I can't tell you how many times since I was threatened with prosecution that I've gone to bed and looking through my bedroom window and expecting, you know, I wonder if tonight is the night that I'm going to see the red lasers piercing through my, you know, my shades at night. And so these thoughts are constantly in my head, and then you and I say them together, and then maybe even me as a journalist, because I've written hundreds of thousands of words, you know, millions probably over the last 20 years, but I've written hundreds of thousands probably already about January 6th. I've written enough material for a book already. It's just not compiled and such, and there's more coming. But with that said, anything could be misconstrued, and you know, and I wonder because I said what I said about this particular FBI agent or this particular AUSA or this particular whatever, I wonder if they're going to just get pissed off at me and decide that, okay, we're going to go get this guy.
Well, I'd say there is that these people, they're consummate professionals, and most, for the good of the system, most of them have trained themselves not to do things personally. Now it's not 100% certainly, but again, it's people struggling to do the best job they can, where we've all been dealt there's a stacked deck. And the fact that we got dealt a stacked deck, it's not really clear why, who did it. We don't know who the dealer is. And we're all struggling to basically comply with our obligations as citizens and as moral human beings as best we can, given these circumstances. So when I say that, like, yeah, I mean, are there bad apples in the system? Yeah, there's bad apples. Are there bad teachers?
Every
system. Bad teachers. Are there bad people who, you know, work in wherever, right? Who
doesn't matter where it is.
Serial killers, yeah, sure, right? They're everywhere. But also in these agencies are people who wear white hats. And I believe that that's the majority. And they do what they can within the system to help us.
Are they going to come to our aid?
I think they already have. In fact, I have good indications of that. So, you know, like everybody, and by the way, they don't send you a memo and say, hey, by the way, you know, you should thank me for whatever. That's not how it works.
Well, that's the memo I want. I want that memo.
Look, and I want to, okay. We know there are over 100 journalists who I believe can be construed as, you know, reasonable interpretation of journalists. Me, I think everybody's a journalist, but, you know, I'm an absolutist on that, who are there on January 6th. There is some selection process in terms of how it seems to me and any rational, you know, it's hard to find these because right now you have to really do an investigation to be able to figure out who and what and where and how and all this stuff. But ultimately, the ex post facto review of that, it's going to look very troubling to the Department of Justice. Right. Ultimately, it will trouble the Department of Justice. So I happen to know that there's probably some people in the department who look at your situation and say, you know what? I'm a loyal Department of Justice. I don't want the Department of Justice to be viewed this way. You know,
I agree with Brad. Ultimately, I agree with you on that. In my case in particular, I think that once the USA in charge of my case saw the overwhelming response I got from the press and the media and the requests for interview and that sort of thing, they went, oh, well, crap.
And by the way, it wasn't because that person was frightened or concerned. It's just like out of her sense of fairness and with the additional context. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because these people, you have to understand, on a moment-to-moment basis, they're trying to do the right thing from a justice perspective, right? So, and that's why, like, we'll never know. But depending on what the circumstances were that this person was under, that may have been a great act of courage in not doing anything. I don't expect to get an email about it, right?
I desperately want to believe that those white hats are still out there and doing.
Of course they are. These are institutions that go back, and everybody involved in, they don't want the institutions, to the extent they're being used in a way that we fear they are in certain aspects of their operations. Most people in those institutions are very concerned about that. And they're struggling to figure out ways that they can get the institution to step away from the vehicle. And it's precisely in these cases, I mean, like, it just so happens, I happen to get involved with a couple, and I'm working on some others, where if they really look at the evidence, they know it's not there.
So, or no, we're back to Harrelson here, correct?
Yeah. So,
yeah, okay.
So going back to, you know, Speaker Pelosi, Majority Leader McConnell, they're saying the kinds of things that I would expect elected officials to say, but does it create incredible prejudice for anybody being charged in the district? Does it put pressure on the judiciary in the DC circuit? Absolutely. There's judges who say, I mean, these are judges who, by the way, classes of federal judges, these people are beyond reproach. I mean, they're like the pinnacle of society in terms of like the lives you'd want to live, like everything about, like, I, you know, as part of being a member of the bar, these are institutions that you just cherish, you know. But to have gone through this event on the heels of COVID-19, that itself layered in this terrible constitutional deprivation and
suspension of civil liberties.
Everything, right? And you know, there's if you look at the statements that have been made by judges in detention hearings that pre-adjudicate guilt, mm-hmm. that are sometimes bordering on a little bit inflammatory. Certainly, some would argue might elicit some prejudice. I'm not suggesting the judges I'm in front of, but I've seen other cases of this. Mm-hmm. There's even I think it was a circuit court judge who basically said, I'm looking out my window at the Capitol surrounded by a fence. And, you know, I'm angry by that, something along those lines. Yeah. I mean, this is the kind of thing, like, you know, if you lived in DC during this time, you felt besieged. And it's really easy. It's like the entire system that all had a role to play in terms of making mistakes and acting without perfection, as we all do as humans who aren't perfect and as agencies that are not perfect.
Well, if you lived in DC during this time, you were besieged by two different circumstances, as you've already elucidated. You were besieged by this appearance of this, you know, the National Guard there for months and those fences surrounding right. the quote unquote freest country in the world. And this is all fenced in with, you know, army and air guard troops surrounding the Capitol for months at a time. And then also you were under siege because you couldn't go shopping or you couldn't go to a restaurant or you couldn't sit outside. You couldn't go inside for a dinner at a restaurant, whatever the case is. And you had to wear a mask every day and this dystopian thing. And DC was as worse as any city in America in terms of their COVID protocols, the severity of their COVID protocols. So it's, I understand that, which brings me back to the, you know, previous question is, you know, how in the world can you possibly seat a fair and impartial jury in that town? How's that even possible?
Very, very hard, particularly the dynamic I see, and this is just speaking as an observer of history and observer, you know, just I'm an American, right? Mm-hmm. It's like every institution involved, they can't agree on anything, except that people who went into the Capitol on January 6th, we can blame them for everything.
Yeah.
And gosh, if people can't see that as being problematic, that you shouldn't join in on these systems, unanimity, that we can just exercise all of civilization's woes and all of our pain related to, like, what was done to our children by locking them down and masking them and forcing them to get medical experiments. And the FDA colluded with Pfizer. How are we investigating parading grandmas when the exactly. FDA exactly. and Pfizer colluded and went to a federal court and said, Your Honor, all of these documents related to approval of the FDA of this Pfizer experimental Pfizer vaccine must be sealed for 75 years.
75 years, right.